Session number 17772.
Right hand then, rail four.
It wasn't worth arguing about this business because what did it matter?
This was somebody who was saying you landed on D plus one, not
Yes,
D.
sorry. What did it matter when you landed? I mean, we were bringing in lads from the Canadian 2nd Infantry Division during August, and later on we were bringing back bodies of those boys, and they had just landed, and they were just as dead as anyone who had landed on D-Day. So what did it matter? It never interested me. And of course, especially later on, when what happened was that the 282 became a company of lesser qualified medical people, the ones who were not A1 were brought back into 282, and 101 then were made up of all the A1s of 282, and so then we became 101. And of course, here again, we met up with it again. We are the D-Day boys, they used to sing, see? And of course, assuming that we, but that is irrelevant, really, to me. Whatever day that we landed on, we all had our job to do, and that was the main important thing. So, as I say, the unit took 3 days altogether to land, and the headquarters that we made, that we came back to, was a chateau. And I was in contact with the mayor of Berniers at one time, and he told me that his granddad was the owner of the chateau that we stayed, that we took over. We were dug into the ground there. And going back to the various things that could happen, this perhaps was one of the uneasy moments. We had a Scotch boy, and we were dug into the ground with the framework of the canopies of the Bedford over us, you see, so that we had the canvas thing over. And this boy, he'd enjoyed his drink. And a month after D-Day, the officer quarter, officers' mess goods were starting to come in, which of course included drink. And then there was a great hue and cry because a bottle of gin was missing. You know, it's amazing, isn't it? The middle of a war going on around you, a bottle of gin was missing. Now, our Scottish boy, he was a very, very cute boy. He had his bottle of gin. And what he did, we had 3 steps dug out into the dugout. And so he made one a fosse. He had a bit of wood that he fastened with a bit of turf, and the bottle of gin resided within. And I can tell you that was that was more frightening to us in that, but I had nothing to do with it than what was going on around us. But he got away with it as it happened, and he had his bottle of gin, but it wasn't to our liking to think that the evidence was right there in our bivouac. But there it was. And the shelling of the beachhead was still going on at that time. I think perhaps the German high commander suddenly realized that perhaps it was vulnerable, that there was such a concentration along the actual beachhead. I don't know why they hadn't thought of shelling, concentrating on that shelling before, but when they did start, they did it. The duck unit that was in the next orchard to us created a lot of casualties there because the lads were actually resting and were underneath their vehicles, and they were hit. And now I wonder, okay, the officer that we had during these landings, he was, unfortunately for us, a public school boy of the upper class who still maintained the snobbery of the upper class, and he was most caustic at times. I know that he referred to me as a country bumpkin many a time, with a education that was almost less than naught, but that was the way that he would act. And one of the worst aspects happened that when this shelling occurred, that his nerve completely broke, and he stood in the middle of the chateau grounds, waved his arms, waving in the air, his eyes bulging, foam, and he was immediately shipped back to UK because he completely lost his nerve. And we had then...
How old was he about?
Possibly 25-ish, thereabouts.
So what was he, a captain?
Lieutenant. And he was shipped right back immediately. We never saw him again, never. The officer then that had landed, reserve officer evidently, came to us then, was a Geordie around the Newcastle area, down to earth, and it was a much better unit. We related much better then. But it was a very unfortunate incident, and the one that sort of sticks in your mind.
Was that the only case of shell shock that you saw?
Only one. The only one that we've ever known, yeah. Yeah. But...
Did you feel sorry for him?
No, not a bit. Not because of his attitude to us in the beginning. Right throughout the time that he was with us, which would have been about 3 or 4 months. No, certainly not. It seemed rather appropriate to us, really. You know, it's a very sad thing to happen because he was the leader. I mean, we were only boys ourselves, weren't we? 20 years of age.
But he wasn't hit by anything?
No, not a thing. The unit next to us had been hit by the shells. And, of course, it was, I can never understand, I've never got to the real story of it, but when these shells were coming, it was almost as if they had an extra trajectory built into the actual thing itself, because it would come over, you would hear a second explosion, you'd hear the bang, and then you'd hear another. Almost as if it was an added one to make them reach a further trajectory. I've never found the secret of that. Nobody seems to agree that there is an extra trajectory under a shell. But we definitely heard a double bang, which told us then that we would be the target. But that's it. Shelling of the beachhead. We had a little bit of an amusing incident after that. Sergeant, I think it was Sergeant Zazel, or such a name as that. He opened the Derby book in the orchard. The Derby was being raced at Epsom, and Sergeant Zazel evidently was a bookie over in England, and he got his blackboard out, and he was taking horse-shilling bets on the horses. Yeah, needless to say, we didn't win.
Were you a sergeant yourself?
No, not there. Not there, not until I reached Palestine. I was still driver then. So after that, of course, then the battles had to be followed. I remember Villers Bocage. This was where the flamethrowers came into action. The whole area, the woods around, burnt. The village itself absolutely shattered. And Tilly Cicero's, which changed hands about 6 times, forward and back, forward and back, forward and back. But we came away from that area then towards the Carpiquet air strip, towards Caen, and that was when we finally went through Caen and through to Falaise and that.
What was the state of Caen?
Pardon?
What was the state of the city of Caen?
Shattered. It was attacked by about 300 bombers that did no good at all. I think I was in the American sector at that time when they came over. Came over very, very low, wave after wave after wave. And evidently for all the damage they caused to the city of Caen. Evidently, it didn't touch the German army at all. We didn't know this, of course, not until much later. History told us that. But evidently, it didn't. It's just destroyed. Yeah, it was a devastating thing. Going on then from Falaise and that gap, I remember that we were sort of working around the Polish First Armored Division, and it was unfortunate that the American boys up in the sky, I suppose what they saw down below was a like a jigsaw puzzle. It didn't make no cohesion at all. So they attacked what they thought was right, and unfortunately, of course, they attacked their own, so that the Polish Armored Division that morning lost about 50 of their troops with what is known now as friendly bombing. But it happens. It's a confusion of war, isn't it?
Did you see anything of that yourself?
We were near to it. We didn't involve ourselves because they looked after themselves. I mean, we had other jobs to do. We were struggling along. It's like a relay team. The munition would be coming up to there, then to there, then to there. It's like a relay team, you say. So you happen to be either in the first part of it, you know, bringing it from the beach, or you could be the second part of it, or the final part of it, taking it to the actual scene. So you just had to get on with your own thing. You couldn't involve yourself. It was nothing to do with you. It was, they had to look after themselves. The German army was fighting its way out, and yeah. So I think the next impression after that, of course, we took, it was just over a week, I think, that we went right through France and arriving over the Belgian border. But of course, the next frightening thing, and it was, when we came to the Seine, and it seemed a mighty wide river at that point to me, but the engineers had been busy and constructed the pontoon bridge across, and of course the whole transport unit had to go across, and of course as you went onto the pontoon bridge, so the river was still flowing, and you could feel yourself moving with the water. And I think we were mighty glad when we got to the other side. Of course, then, as I say, it took barely a week. And of course, as you know, by history would tell you then that we moved so fast that how could you possibly keep up with keeping the materials up? The lines of communication were far too stretched. We were coming back, meeting the second convoy coming up. The first convoy had done their job and brought theirs up, see, in the second, and we were bringing up, but it was hopeless to maintain. And I expect you know by history what happened there, that a whole German army was able to escape across the Scheldt estuary and come down and hinder us with the garden section of Market Garden, because up there we were trying to get through to Nijmegen, and of course the lines of communication were being cut across because this army, which everybody evidently had forgotten about, was able to escape across the Scheldt estuary there. Von Zeigen, some just name of that.
Don't worry about the name.
Yeah, anyway, he brought his old army across. And what would worry you in that aspect was that the Allies had complete domination of the sky, complete, and of the sea at that time. And yet a whole army could be ferried across 6 miles of the Scheldt estuary and escape over onto the main Holland mainland. It's a marvel. As I say, you can't take it away from the German army. They weren't novices to the job. Whatever, you know, we may feel against them. In fact, I did meet German ex-soldiers, because my neighbor over at the previous house that we lived in was very friendly with a German family, and in turn they would bring many visitors over, and quite half a dozen of them had actually been German soldiers. Quite charming people. One, in fact, had been SS, but Hubert had been wounded in some way. We couldn't take him out to a meal. He always had to eat privately because of his damage. And the reason why he was SS was quite simple. He had choices. Either, as I said, the Russian front or some other terrible job, or being in the SS. So it wasn't much of a choice, really. But that's why Hubert was SS. But he was quite a nice chap. So remarkable in that sense, wasn't it?
So you met these Germans after the war?
After the war, yeah, much. Yeah, much after the war.
Can you tell me about your own experiences from September 1944 onwards in Europe? What happened to you next?
There was, as I say, in a battle, it's absolute confusion. But having seen the video of the Rhine crossing, we weren't part of that. By some means, because we were still part of the Canadian. Although, if anybody might think of us as general dog's bodies, I don't know, but at the Battle of the Bulge, for instance, whilst we were still at Diergem, which was a suburb of Brussels, at the Battle of the Bulge, the 51st Artillery Division was brought down to help Plug. And we became part, for that moment, of the 51st Artillery Division. And we came down to the Ardennes area because of the threat of the German army coming through. They were trying to make for Antwerp. In other words, to cut off we who were actually in Belgium and Holland. And had they succeeded, it would have been a pretty terrifying blow. But fortunately, they were stopped. Units came down and plugged the gap, cut off, I think, from what I can gather, the fuel supply for the German army, which of course meant that they had to retreat back the way they came. But as far as I could make out, and as far as whatever contact we had with troops that were coming back, it evidently that it was a very raw and experienced American unit that had been put at the forward there. And of course the Germans were very cute and knew this, and they were to attack. But just to say then, we were part of the 51st Artillery Division at that time. But anyway, coming back then to rejoin the Canadian, which was by that time the Canadian's 2nd Infantry Division. Montgomery did make the remark after the Normandy campaign that of all the units involved in the Normandy campaign, the Canadian 3rd Infantry Division suffered the highest casualties. In other words, it was 2/3, which made a very frightening thought when I thought, going back to when we were standing in that field on the inspection of King George VI, that the man possibly to the right of me was going to be killed, and the man possibly to the left of me was going to be wounded, which is what it meant, 2/3 casualties. So by that time, we were part of the Canadian 2nd Infantry Division, which of course was concentrated more to the north. they were doing the seaboard side of the invasion. The Americans, of course, being right inland, the British in the center. And so memory has to be taxed here, because it must have been that we must have gone up through, when Arnhem was liberated, we got across that bridge, and then because we finished up over the lower Rhine, beyond that, to enter into Germany from Enschede, and then over to Hanover.
What were your experiences in Germany?
Not a lot, because there wasn't any actual fighting. We were not involved with any fighting.
But did you have any contact with German civilians?
Not really. It was more, we seemed to be the rural. We certainly didn't go into any large. I mean, when I mentioned Hanover, it wasn't into the town of Hanover. It was in that area. And no, there wasn't a lot of contact with it. We had our directive from General Montgomery. I've got it in there that we have no contact with the, friendliness, not with the German populace, small children. That would seem remarkable today, wouldn't it, to have a directive like that? Because the do-gooders were very quickly up in arms with children. You're allowed to play with children, small children. But there was no fraternization, and that was the direct order.
Not with the adults.
So,
and then I think after the war you went to Palestine?
Yeah, well, when we came back from there, we were called back to the UK, and we thought, well, lovely, we're going to have a nice little rest now. But it wasn't to be. We had a fortnight's leave, and away we went back to the unit. The next thing was Liverpool. Next thing was the tropical kit being fitted out on the boat, and away we went. Past the ship, still sunk in the Mersey, and next stop was Gibraltar. We got off, had a look at the rock. Next stop was Malta. Got off and had a look at Valletta Harbour. And then the next stop was Portside. On the railway, Ismailia or Ismailia, whichever way you like to pronounce it, and then out to Telekabir. Out in the desert, acclimatized, visit perhaps down to Cairo, pyramids, and then up to near Tel Aviv. The camp was called Sarafand, and there we became part of the mandate forces of Palestine. One of the first tasks was not very unpleasant, that evidently two RAF sergeants had been kidnapped by a Stern gang, I believe it was, and were taken into Orchard and Hung. And this was the first thing that we learnt when we arrived at Sarafand. But we did have a few skirmishes. There were three terrorist gangs, and the transport was the obvious target. When you think of an army, it wasn't an army of occupation, it was an army mandate. And when you think of it, there were no tanks, there were no army units, such as a battle unit. It was infantry, which was necessary to patrol, and we were transport, and that's it. That was your occupying mandate forces. And so became, I suppose, rather important, because we were the means of the communication and taking everything wherever it had to go. But we had several postings from there. We went to Atlet, which was a Crusader castle there, Atlet, A-T-L-I-T. And it was a very dirty camp. In fact, we lost three boys there with typhoid. They were buried in Haifa Cemetery. very dirty camp. It was Indians that were there before us. The thing was crawling with lizards and great 2 foot long things, grass snakes that were about 8 foot long, chameleons and scorpions. That was a lucky escape because I was under the mosquito net and I had a wicker basket with books in, and I was there sorting out, getting the books, and down the bottom of it was a great scorpion with his claws ready. So it was lucky I hadn't put my hand down too deeply in that one. We used to make the most of our stay there. The cinema was an open-air effort with sacking around the edges of it. And you would see the films by bright moonlight. It was a particularly nice little bay that we used to enjoy our swimming there. There was a clump of rocks out, half a mile out, that we could swim out to. You couldn't land, you just swim out to them and swam back. And that made a nice pleasant evening. Then to Haifa. And here was very interesting because being the sergeant of a unit then, I used to have to take a section onto the warship, which was HMS Ajax at that time, and we would beat the seaboard looking for illegal immigrants coming in, which of course had to be stopped. If they were too close to Palestine, of course there was no other way but to bring them in. And then they would be put in beside concentration camps. And here was a remarkable thing that I could think of, because when we reached the outskirts of Hanover there, we were near Belsen, and we came into contact with the remnants that were coming out of Belsen, you know, the Jews. So there we were, there to help, and then the next minute we were in a position that we were being spat at and sworn at and reviled at because we are keeping them in a concentration area. So quite the reverse. From one minute we were the liberators and the next minute we were the oppressors. And it's not a very nice situation.
Did you find any illegal immigrants when you were
patrolling? Oh yes. The boats were coming in crammed. Yeah, they were full of lice and full of, you know, that is appalling. I mean, they were sleeping in their own filth. And I mean, you had to feel sorry. They were trying to escape. And we knew what they were trying to escape from. But there was nothing you could do. They were illegal immigrants. There was only a certain set number of Jewish immigrants allowed into Palestine. And if they were illegal, that was it. They had to be put in beside this barbed wire compound. And naturally, they were not very happy about it.
Did you have to use force to arrest them?
Oh yes, yes, we had to, because they were fighting for their very existence. They certainly didn't want to be sent back, because I should imagine that they would go back to something pretty terrible if they were sent back, wherever they came from.
Were there any injuries on either side when you used force?
Oh yeah, there would be, yes. Had to be. Yeah.
Did you get injured?
No. No.
Were you armed?
Yes.
What with?
Rifles. I had pistol.
Did you have to fire?
No. No. Threaten, yes. But not fire, no. But I expect some did.